Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 8th of May, and before we start the program, we're celebrating 1 year today. So my thanks to colleagues Nebuhle, Ed, Zikona and Palesa who put the show together every day. Coming up on today's program, the Mayor of George on the building accident tragedy, Eskom's billion rand battle with the city of Johannesburg, how Takealot will fight off Amazon, a new AI strategy to help fight rhino poaching, and an expert view on South Africa's student funding shambles. Eskom is taking the Johannesburg power entity City Power to court for defaulting on its payments and, wait for it, to the tune of 1 billion rand. In a statement overnight, the power utility said it had no choice but to approach the High Court in Johannesburg to force City Power to pay. More now from energy commentator Hugo Kruger, who is watching that story for us. Hugo, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. This is a staggering amount of money. Why on earth has it been allowed to fester for such a long time, do you think?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for having me. There's a few issues to separate here. One is the fact that Johannesburg is defaulting in this debt. But the other one is that the way electricity works in South Africa has been that for a very long time, lots of people got electricity simply for free, or they were, you know, given debt, which we knew they could not pay back. And this is sort of the chickens coming home to roost, in my view. The fact is that we have many bankrupt municipalities across the country that simply won't ever be able to pay back their debt. And the Treasury has made the decision to absorb it. Now, what I'm reading between the lines here is that more prominent municipalities are sort of taking advantage of this. And this is probably what Eskom would accuse the Johannesburg municipality of.
Eskom, Hugo says, and I quote, "The non-payment undermines the utility's ability and stability and ability to maintain essential infrastructure." It goes on to say it's also affected Eskom's ability to invest in new technologies and to meet the province's growing energy demands. Whichever way you look at it, this is sheer negligence, and it cannot be allowed to continue, surely.
Sure, it cannot be. But Eskom is correct in a certain sense here, which is that South Africa, you see, South African, NERSA, let me start there, has been forcing Eskom to sell at what we call the marginal cost of electricity for a very long time, which is basically the bare bone. And there was never any fat in the system to allow it to recapitalize. And this is sort of what's coming in. Now, the biggest story behind this is that South Africa as a whole is underinvested in infrastructure. But nobody wants to be the guy that pays the money for the infrastructure that we need. So is it the municipalities? Is it going to be treasuries? Is it going to be taxes? Is it going to be high electricity tariffs? The system is leaking. And this is just another way of it expressing itself.
So is there any way of fixing this in the short term, do you think, so that Eskom is satisfied and that at some point City Power, and by that I mean the residents of Johannesburg, don't end up paying for this, both with a loss of electricity and through more money from our wallets?
I think that the court standoff will determine who pays what. My suspicion is that Eskom is going to lose this battle because of the municipal debt. Because Treasury has been giving municipalities debt extensions, or they're going to bail them out. But will the citizens or the residents of Johannesburg pay the tab at the end of the day? I think it's a real question. The answer is yes. Somewhere along the line, they're going to have to pay for this. And how is that going to affect itself? I suspect the municipality is eventually going to have, if municipality is going to be forced to pay, they're going to have to hike tariffs. If Eskom is going to be forced to pay, there's a new black hole. Okay, that's either Treasury, so that's higher taxes for the whole country, or it will be higher tariffs at the end of the day. But something has to correct itself for this money to flow back.
And as you rightly point out, this is not just an issue regarding the city of Johannesburg, but it is smaller entities,
yeah.
And that has cascaded then into some of the bigger metros. So let's make no mistake here, this is a nationwide problem.
Yes, absolutely. It's a systemic issue across South Africa. And the issue is simply that we gave electricity, we subsidized electricity for a very long time. And now, as I say again, the chickens are coming home, the rest of us. So the way I see it, how it has to be handled, is Treasury has to say, okay, we are going to carry the tab of the bankrupt municipalities effectively, or they can bail out Eskom for as long as that continues. But Eskom's business model has to start making sense, which is, who is Eskom's customer? That's the first thing we need to ask here. Is the customer the residentials, the industrials, the usual customers, or the commercials, or is it those customers plus Treasury bailing out, plus the subsidies to the municipalities? And that is the question we're not asking. Now, if you add all of that, those things together, let's say it's only going to be the customers, the question should be, what should the price of electricity be? And you always conclude it has to be higher. And you remember, Andre, the writer, said this a few years ago, that electricity is too cheap in South Africa, and everyone was attacking him in the media. He was entirely correct. We have, people don't want to hear it, very affordable electricity in South Africa. It's too affordable. And the fact that it's too affordable expresses itself in situations such as this, such as the municipal debt. And we have to come to terms with this as a country.
Well, we can't be in a situation where Treasury just keeps bailing out state-owned entities. I mean, we've seen the situation with South African Airways, never ending. Surely it cannot keep doing the same kind of thing for Eskom.
No, it can't. But you see, South African Airways is, in a sense, a simpler issue to solve because you've got Kalula.com, right? You've got British Airways. You've got different forms of aircraft carriers. So you can, in a certain sense, say, okay, this is just a government bailing out something. But electricity is quintessential for economic growth. It's an enabler of economic growth. If Eskom goes tomorrow, the entire economy goes to it. So you see, South Africans could always run away from all our state-owned entities to alternatives. But what do you do with electricity on highways and things of that nature, natural monopolies? You can't run away from it. So we have no choice but to solve it. And it has to be solved as a regulatory reform before we can say who pays what. The business has to make sense.
And there's no indication, Hicho, at this point that Eskom in any way is going to change its business model, as you've suggested, or is there?
No, it's not. They say it's running. The money is running away from them. So certainly electricity sales have fallen. And this is the other problem, right? So now you've got a company whose electricity sales are falling due to rooftop solar coming in, people just finding alternatives, or just every industry is leaving the country. And at the same time, it needs money to recapitalize. Now, the question is, how do you recapitalize if you're losing customers? This is a big problem. So somewhere we have to come. I'm not sure how one funds this thing. Do we give it a one-off bailout to say now we're going to fix all the infrastructure and then the municipalities have to start paying, and if they don't pay, we switch off the lights? Politically, I see that being a very difficult one. But that's ultimately what we need to work towards. We can't have a situation where people are basically getting free electricity. It doesn't make sense.
All right, Hicho Kruger, that is a very stark analysis. Thank you very much for joining us. This is MoneyWeb at Midday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, we reported in some detail on the program yesterday about Amazon officially launching its South African unit, very simply amazon.co.za. And that, I think, also marks a pivotal moment in the country's e-commerce sector. It's launching a real fight, a real onslaught against retailers in a market that is worth something like 1.3 trillion rand. Joining us now is Gerard Janse van Rensburg, who's an equity analyst at Flagship Asset Management. Gerard, a very warm welcome to you. So the big challenge, I guess, for Amazon is to start differentiating itself from existing competitors like Takealot. They're also the international entrants like Shine and Temu in the South African market. How difficult is that going to be, or does this ultimately come down to a debate, a choice around price?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think there's normally three reasons why customers use a certain platform. The reasons being selection of products available, prices in relation to to other platforms, and the experience or the service you get. Firstly, on the selection of products, I think Amazon launched with quite a smaller selection currently, and it does look quite limited when you compare that to Takealot. In terms of price, it appears very similarly priced, but some products are actually more expensive, a few tech items that I just looked at. And then the experience, that remains to be seen. So it will be interesting to see this evolve over the coming months.
So given the importance then of local partnership and supplier, particularly with an eye on price, it's important then that Amazon has a strategy to integrate local brands and products into its platform. How difficult is that going to be? Or do you think that brands themselves are simply going to have no choice because of the heft and the influence that Amazon has both locally and internationally?
I believe brands will certainly have to look at listing their products on Amazon. Globally, about 60% of the products on Amazon.com are independent sellers. And I think this is an opportunity for entrepreneurs in South Africa as well. This will likely benefit entrepreneurs in terms of competition because Takealot, for example, also charges you fees to sell on the platform. And I think some healthy competition in South Africa would be good for everyone involved.
It's also about establishing, Gerard, a robust delivery infrastructure across South Africa, particularly in the more remote or rural areas. That's not necessarily a problem that Amazon has had to deal with in more developed markets like the United States and Europe, for instance.
Yes, that will be a new challenge for them. Which I think they will take on as they've taken on other challenges. We saw their financial results a week ago, and their international e-commerce operations have been on a roll. They've been on a big, huge efficiency drive, so I think they will take it in their stride.
So let's look at organizations like ShopRite and Woolworths, and I'm also very interested to read about this new concept of mini macros. We've got Amazon entering the market. How is it going to influence the strategic plans, do you think, of the more traditional brick-and-mortar retailers?
I think the brick-and-mortar retailers will always play a part. I mean, in South Africa, we prefer to just buy certain things in store, and I think that's not likely to change overnight. So I think in the short term, we're currently looking at still buying certain products in store. And it remains to be seen how much of that will shift to online in the coming years.
It's also important to look at what Amazon is doing in terms of job creation or potential job creation in South Africa, as well as the development of small business. Do you think that's going to happen with any degree of alacrity?
I think, the job creation, there has been reports previously about the number of jobs that Amazon has created in South Africa. And if some small and medium businesses can make a business out of selling on Amazon, that will be great for them.
How significant do you think, Gerard, the role of data analytics is going to be in shaping Amazon's strategies and customer engagement in this country, given the success that it has in other markets? Surely that gives it an immediate advantage over a Takealot. Or does Takealot have that same set of metrics, do you think, that it can leverage to its benefit?
In my opinion, Takealot will definitely have the same metrics that they look at, and they'll definitely have some data that they are analyzing behind the scenes. I mean, just if you Google something and shortly afterwards you get a Takealot ad allowing you to purchase that exact product, that's a good example of exactly that. It will be interesting to see how it evolves because Amazon has a Prime membership in the US. It costs about $15 a month, but the pricing will likely differ here. And that includes free two-day shipping as a standard with no minimum purchase price. Prime Video, which is equivalent to Netflix, that's all bundled with, and Prime Music with more than 100 million songs. And I think that's going to be quite attractive for consumers that are currently purchasing on Takealot, where you could pay one fee and have your Takealot shipping basically for free on Amazon and all these other products.
That is a very compelling offer. And just finally, what we haven't mentioned, and I referenced it at the beginning, is the likes of Shine and Temu in the South African market also playing very aggressively and something to watch. And theirs is purely a price play.
Yes. Theirs is purely a price play. The way I see it, the experience you get, it remains to be seen in South Africa, especially, as you mentioned, rural areas. And we'll have to see what Amazon does to conquer that space.
Well, let's see what happens in the coming weeks. Gerard Janse van Vuuren, Equity Analyst, Flagship Asset Management, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's pivot now from e-commerce to education. And there is absolutely no question that the National Student Financial Aid Scheme is in trouble, culminating recently in the board being dissolved by the Higher Education Minister and the organization then being placed under administration. So where to now as far as this is concerned? Because it is an important mechanism as far as student life is concerned. Tandi Lewin is with us, Associate Professor at the Ali Mazuri Center for Higher Education Studies. She has written extensively on the problem. Tandi, good afternoon to you and a very warm welcome. What immediate reforms then, in your opinion, are necessary to stabilize the scheme in the wake of this administrative overhaul? And how much time do you think it's going to take?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and to your listeners. Thanks for having me. Just a quick disclaimer. I used to work in the department with responsibility for oversight of NSFAS, so that's where a lot of my experience comes from. I've been at UJ for a year now. I think the real problems are administrative. It's quite a relief in a way that there is an administrator in place, though I wonder, you know, if he knew what he was letting himself in for, because it's a huge challenge. And maybe just quick three things. One is that the systems and capacity of the entity itself in terms of human capacity, but also in terms of their IT systems, are really not fit for purpose. And this is both an historic problem, and it's been intensified by some of the very ill-conceived decisions that NSFAS entered into over the last year or so, in particular the direct payment solution, the accommodation of take agreements and other such things. But those problems are historic, and so a properly designed IT system is needed for NSFAS. And then the other big issue that I would want to emphasize is just the fact that NSFAS operates as an ecosystem. It can't operate on its own. It cannot operate without the support and the collaboration of the institutions where the students are studying, because you're not just a NSFAS student because you can not afford to access higher education, but also because you are registered in a funded program. And so it's very important that NSFAS is able to track the academic performance of students and make sure that students qualify for NSFAS academically as well. And because there's so many people that would qualify for NSFAS, but there are limited places in the universities and the TVET colleges.
So let's look at both of those issues. The IT problem, I would imagine, is one simply of spending more money, upgrading the system and making sure that the right people are managing it. Perhaps the collaboration with universities and TVET colleges is more difficult, though. How does one go about that to make sure that they're all part of this ecosystem that you refer to and are pulling and operating in the same direction?
So, I mean, it's not easy because you do need to, you can't avoid that collaboration. And in fact, the university, there's quite low levels of trust at the moment, as you can imagine, because the universities and TVET colleges in particular bear the brunt of what happens when students don't receive their allowances or there are over and under payments. So it's very important that there are high levels of trust, and there have been before, but you do need integrated systems. You can't simply just build a system at NSFAS without engaging with the institutions and ensuring that there's some kind of meaningful integration that takes place. Otherwise, you can't have real-time decision-making about student funding, where students are living, accommodation trends, and things like that. And you know, just to say that the commercial banks would equally struggle to pay students accurately and without risk if those systems don't exist. Yeah.
Two other issues, Tandi. One is addressing allegations of corruption and mismanagement that led to those administrative changes that I referred to earlier. And the other is for the organization to be a lot more transparent. Again, getting that right is more difficult, a little bit more opaque, perhaps.
Yeah, it is difficult. But the transparency is certainly assisted when you have institutions working together with NSFAS, because the universities in particular and the TVET colleges who have less administrative capacity but do work closely with NSFAS, they know what's going on. When you talk to people in the universities who are involved in student financial aid, they know exactly what's going on at NSFAS and when there are problems and when there are not. So that can be assisted. I mean, there are recommendations that have been made around the governance of NSFAS as well as the IT systems, which were made by a ministerial committee of inquiry that was set up by Minister Nzimande and reported in 2021. It's not a public report, but it has been discussed in Parliament. And those recommendations need to be looked at. There was another issue around... what was the other issue?
The other issue was just making sure that transparency and accountability is ensured.
Yeah, look, it was about the alleged corruption. I mean, I believe that the latest report that was commissioned by the NSFAS board, looking partly into the allegations against the former chair, I believe that report has been given to the administrator. And I think everyone will be very interested in knowing, what that report is. I did read something yesterday that suggested that there was those allegations really hadn't been proved, the outer allegations. So I think we're all kind of waiting for that information. And if this money, which is in really, really important public money that has played a incredibly powerful role in the transformation of our higher education system and our society, if that public money has gone, for any nefarious purposes, then I really hope that the people that are behind that are, faced any kind of sanctions that they should face.
Thandi Lewin, thank you very much indeed from the University of Johannesburg.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, to the best of our knowledge, over 40 workers still remain trapped under rubble at the construction site in George. The Department of Labour and Western Cape Disaster Management Inspectors are on the scene. I also understand that the province has appointed independent structural engineers to probe the cause of this collapse. Joining us now on the programme is the Executive Mayor of George Municipality, Leon van Wyk. A very warm welcome to you. I won't keep you long. I do know that time is of the essence here. First of all, can you bring us up to speed on the state of the rescue itself?
Yes, good day to you, Jeremy. Yes, the rescue is obviously proceeding. I've just walked off the site and come to my office. The municipal building precinct is right next across the road from where this apartment building has collapsed. So they're busy with a very vast undertaking now, where they're preparing to move from a rescue phase into a recovery phase, which will probably take place or commence on the recovery tomorrow. We are now approaching the 48-hour mark, and the rescuers have attempted to take out all of those workers where they had heard signals or sounds coming from people under the rubble. And so now it is a matter of looking to see how they can lift these concrete slabs, these huge concrete slabs, and lift them off one by one. We need to take into account that this is a four-story apartment building on top of a parking garage area, and then there's a basement as well. And we've had that complete collapse that has now taken place here. So they need to work fairly meticulously here, and they are at present, they are trying to lift a portion of that slab, and they've got a very big crane in place, and therefore this is going to be the first little test on how they do it. And then once they've worked out that methodology, hopefully they will see if they can work quicker as we progress into the afternoon and the evening.
Leon van Wyk, I wonder if you'd be able to reflect on the human element as far as this is concerned. It is a terrible tragedy. What has this done to the city of George and its residents? I can be absolutely assured that everybody in the city is feeling it.
Yes, no, absolutely. And, we've been absolutely overwhelmed by the generosity and people who are carrying and bringing in food, bringing in refreshments. We've had coffee shops who've opened up at night and have just been sending coffees in. Last night there were even cupcakes being brought in for the rescue workers. So it's quite unbelievable how the community responds. It is something that's a very special feature for George, the way people react. Naturally, we also very concerned about the families of the workers, and particularly those who are still waiting, the trapped workers. So there's a whole humanitarian effort being put together on that side. What we've also had was a request for, good people donate money. And that has also now taken place, and we are quite surprised at how quickly a fair amount of money has started to come into that account.
I did mention that independent structural engineers have been appointed to probe all of this. I would imagine, as far as that is concerned, time is of the essence, because the families particularly and all other stakeholders will be wanting answers as quickly as possible.
Yes, certainly, that is very, very understandable. I think the difficulty that you do have is that there will need to be all sorts of tests that are done on the material that is taken off site, and the in situ situation of the collapse situation, and also to determine where the collapse started, and how that then flowed through, that the entire building collapsed as such. But that work has to continue. There are various numerous structural engineers who are on site today as well, that have been brought in, even from the universities and from the consulting engineers that have been appointed. So they are all certainly making sure that they gather the evidence that they need, that would need to go into that investigation report.
All right. Leon van Wyk is the executive mayor of the George municipality. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
And finally, Addo Elephant National Park in the Eastern Cape has introduced new intelligent collars that use artificial intelligence algorithms to monitor the behavior of its rhino population. And the idea behind that is to protect it against poaching. Joining us now is JP Lowe, who speaks for Sanparks. And first of all, what's driving the thinking here?
You'd know that one of the bigger areas of concern in conservation has been in relation to poaching in particular. And we've been looking at all kinds of interventions about how to push back against the poachers. But at the same time, Sanparks really invest quite a lot in scientifically studying the behavior of all of its conservation estate, whether we are talking about animals themselves, flora, to always try to make sure that we know when our numbers are on the up or on the down, dwindling if ever, or increasing, and what sort of interventions are needed to deal with those. So this particular project is none different other than that. That really what it's about. It's about us doing an intervention that's intended to help us with our conservation management across the whole country to be able to take good care of our country's conservation estate, of course, on behalf of the public. Because ultimately what we do is about that.
It's early days yet, but have there been any specific results as stemming from this project?
I mean, it's a bit early days, as you correctly are saying. So we would need to be given a little bit of time to see what the results do we get. We have done like 21 collars at the moment. So I think that when the time comes in the implementation of this program, we will then communicate what kind of details are we getting really from the research that come. But really, it is about early days to be able to speak to those kind of specifics.
And JP, are you anticipating technological difficulties or challenges in implementing these collars? And if so, how are you going to work to overcome them?
In the first instance, before we even would make a move like that, those are the questions we'll deal with. Because as I'm saying that, we don't want to introduce, for example, interventions that will make it difficult for animals to live in their natural habitat. Because ultimately, this is what having the national parks are about, to make it possible for, even though there's fence, But to the extent that the space is open and animals are able to roam free, that they are not inhibited by interventions, human-made interventions that make it difficult for them to be able to live freely like that. So no, certainly at this point, one can't say that we are experiencing any problems. AI tech make use of towers as well as collars, of course. We're quite comfortable at the moment from the observations we are making that they are not really an impediment in any way whatsoever.
I assume that you'll also put measures in place to ensure the security and integrity of the data once you start to crunch it.
Most certainly. These are implemented on the one hand through, the people we refer to as rangers, right, are also known as conservation officers, if you like. So there is a security element to this, of course, that's being added as an additional to make sure that this data that we have is kept internal to SANParks. You know, we, for example, don't reveal things such as numbers of our population across the parks, specifically for security reasons. Well, we can at the same time report that at a place like Ado Elephant National Park, I mean, we have an increase of more or less about 5%. So the conservation interventions there has been quite positive. We've never really had poaching problems at this park in particular. So our interventions are intended to be preventative at this point. But certainly from a security point of view, and just the security of the data, all of those measures certainly have been put in place.
And I'm assuming that this exercise is not inexpensive. So I guess the question would be, how sustainable is this technology financially for long-term conservation efforts?
We're fortunate to get donations for this particular project from various stakeholders. You know, welfare organizations such as Stop Rhino Poaching came to the party. Animal Survival International, the Brady Hunter Foundation came to the party. Dancing for Rhinos, and also others like Toko Force, who are the developers of Eco Lodge near our park, as well as Roxel Technology, who are the ones who really are the makers of this technology that we're using currently. And one would say that there's something about conservation and a very emotive connection that many have to it. And there's a number of projects that were implementing, made possible by our stakeholders in the private sector, as well as also the NGO sector as well. And from that point of view, we're fairly comfortable that this could continue. If I was to make reference, for example, to another case where in the Mountain Zebra National Park, we just did collaring there of cheetahs. And that project itself, again, has been made possible through various donations. Mm. So from the kind of like attitude, from the demeanor, from the partnerships that we know that are in place and certainly seems to be potentially having a long-term commitment attached to them, we remain convinced that we'll be able to continue on this path of ensuring that we are able to implement this kind of like a project sustainably.
All right, JP Lowe from SANParks, thank you very much indeed. And finally, on our last online poll, Shell's decision to scale back. I asked if it was inevitable, a jobs disaster, or more disinvestment ahead. Over half our respondents saying more big corporate exits are looming. Today, the Amazon take-a-lot battle. Only the price, I'll go local, or I'll wait and see. If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We're live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.